Hello and welcome to Football Memories and Moments. Basically, we've interviewed people who all share one thing, a love of football. In this podcast, we find out their favourite memory, something personal to them, and a moment that stands out forever. We hope you enjoy, and if you do, please like, subscribe and rate. This week's guest is Daniel Storey. Daniel's an excellent writer. Works for Football 365, amongst many things, but is also the author of Portrait of an Icon, which is now sold out. I don't know if Daniel is planning to do another run and raise more money for the Sir Bobby Robson Foundation, as he's already done. So fantastic work there, Daniel. Top stuff. But he's this week's guest, and his memory, getting straight into it, his memory is the first Nottingham Forest game after Brian Clough died. Daniel's a huge Forest fan. He's a Nottingham boy, and he talks about an event that was just pure outpouring of emotion. And I maintain this is a Skype interview, so the quality might dip in and out sound-wise, but I'd like to think not chat-wise. A bit partridge there, but Daniel, that if it had been a face-to-face interview, I think Daniel may have it could have got a bit dusty both ways, because I think it's just a great chat about what Brian Clough meant to the people of Nottingham, what he means to Nottingham Forest, and what he means to Daniel himself. And then for his moment, it's not a specific moment as such. It's the what he calls the rehabilitation of Ronaldo. It's now sort of passé to say, or the in vogue thing to call him the original Ronaldo, but he was, you know, probably, we talked about how Ronaldo is the template for the modern forward, and how he goes from the 1998 World Cup to the 2002 World Cup, which, should you know what you're talking about, you kind of know that those two extremes. Anyway, on with the podcast. Thanks very much for those who have listened. We really appreciate it, and if you could rate, and review and subscribe on iTunes, that would be fantastic. Enjoy the podcast. Thank you.
My memory is Nottingham Forest 2-1 win over West Ham in 2004, or September 2004, although it's far more than that. It's more remembered far more by Forest fans, not just the win over West Ham, but as the game after Brian Clough passed away, and therefore his tribute game.
I'd be very surprised that people didn't know, but for people who don't know, Clough is obviously the ultimate Nottingham Forest legend, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. He's for a man of my age. I was born in 1985, and Clough retired in 1993, and hadn't been in the job for, he'd been in the job for 10 years when I was born. So he is a man who extends over a whole generation of not just Nottingham sport, but Nottingham life, and English football life as well. But to us, he is incredibly special. He was not a perfect man by any means, far from it. But he was not a perfect manager. But he was the manager who took a provincial club, and we're lucky that it was us to consecutive European Cups. I'm sure everyone knows that, but it's impossible, unless you're from the area, to kind of understand just how much Clough dominates, even now dominates Nottingham life. I speak to people and they say, what do you do? And I say, oh, I'm a football writer. And if they're from Nottingham, they say, oh, I've got a Cloughy story for you. And that's kind of how those conversations start in Nottingham, not just with football fans, but with kind of everyone. He's a bit of a rogue parent, or a sort of the godfather of Nottingham. But yeah, he is a huge seam that runs through our sporting life.
And that's an interesting one. And I enjoyed your exact words there. He took a provincial club to back-to-back European Cups, because I remember him when Sky first got the Champions League off ITV.
Yeah,
and they did a promo with Clough. I think it was Sky, because I think Sky have had the Champions League for that long now. But he introduced himself, didn't he, by saying, my name's Brian Clough. You might not know me, but I took a provincial football team to, and he said those exact things, and that, I thought that was great. And but also for people who also don't remember, anyone might listen to this, is that he also had a very successful spell with your most hated rivals.
Yeah, I think definitely our most hated rivals. Yeah, he took Derby to the league title, and I think his success would have been the same. He would have been thought of the same had he not done the Derby thing. But that obviously kind of makes it slightly sweeter in that they had a sort of look what you could have won moment. And he, you know, even during his early spell at Forest, he regretted leaving Derby because of what happened in the interim with Leeds and Brighton, and a kind of tricky point in his career. And it was by no means, you know, he arrived at Forest and we were in the second division. He arrived at us to rebuild his own career as well as to rebuild us as a club. So yes, that obviously makes it slightly more special. But actually, Clough is one of those people in our area, and Forest fans do hate, you know, I'm not a man that hates football fans, it's just not in my nature, but Forest fans do hate Derby fans and vice versa. But Clough is a kind of middle ground. There isn't really a one-upmanship about, you know, he did this with us and he did that with you and he left you to come to us, because everyone's a little bit bigger than that, and time's a bit of a healer on that, and people just see him for who he was. He deserves better than us to kind of nitpick and fight between each other, I think.
Do you think as well, that we're coming to the memory that obviously the day after he died, and you're going to go on hopefully and explain why you wore this, but the question that's been on my mind is, first of all, I'm going to ask you a two-part question. Is one, did you ever really have a choice in being a Forest fan? And secondly, is that day the pinnacle of the sense of belonging in football? And with those two questions, I hopefully you'll answer them as you then proceed to tell us your memory.
Yeah, I didn't really have a choice but support Forest. My mum was born in the northeast, and my grandfather lived in the northeast, and all my mum's family do. My granddad was kind of unusual in that he was a policeman who kind of travelled all over the northeast with his job and didn't actually support one of the teams. He kind of loved football and loved the characters Bob Stokoe and latterly Bobby Robson, but didn't really have an affiliation for a team. But my mum was a Forest fan from living in Nottingham. She started going to the games the year after they won the European Cup, as this idea of travelling around Europe watching Forest, and we got knocked out in the first round. But that was kind of her hooked. That was her hooked, and she took me to my first game when I was four. I got a season ticket at five, and that was about that. And my first season ticket was the penultimate season of Clough. So I saw him at his very end and not particularly pretty times, although obviously heard the stories. And I've said to people before, one really good way of showing what Clough means to this area is that my mum used to threaten me with Brian Clough. That's how it would work. You know, he was a single parent family, and she would say, look, if you do that, Brian Clough will find out. Or if you don't do that, I'll tell Brian Clough. Now, obviously I was very small at that point, but that's kind of how it was. That's how weirdly close we felt to him, and therefore to the club. So no, I never really had a choice.
Is that the first instance then, Daniel, of a football manager being equated to Father Christmas?
I don't know about that, because even as a young person, maybe not at five or six, probably not in fact, but certainly after Clough had left, and actually in the latter days of his reign, which was 93, so I'd have been seven, even at that age, you could tell that something was not quite right. I think Santa Claus is a kind of, I mean, obviously a mythical figure, but a kind of wholly positive mythical figure, whereas Clough was very, as well as being a kind of deity to us and untouchable, he was also very human, you know, with the flaws that come with that. And I think, I mean, I'm changing that in hindsight, but I think even at that age, you kind of understood that you certainly understood that something wasn't quite right, because we got relegated with Brian Clough in his final season. So, but yeah, I think we saw that human element of him even then.
A couple of things I'd like to ask to balance, not to balance things out, but to give a more holistic picture of him, is that the two questions I'd like to ask is do you think Clough made mistakes, particularly around events that Nottingham Forest were involved in, particularly, you know, well, specifically Hillsborough? And also, do you think the way he finished the game, do you think he'd been given that much time to finish his career at Forest in this modern game?
I think he, it wasn't necessarily because of the modern game. I think that's a very easy thing to say, and I'm sure you're right. I think he would have probably have left the club earlier, but it was also because of how powerful he was. That power, that yeah. omnipotence he held at Forest was a huge part, in fact, the main part of our success. It wouldn't have happened without him being so omnipotent. But it also is what caused his downfall, because of the flaws in his personality and because of his addiction to alcohol, and no one had the gumption or even the desire at that point to say, sorry, Brian, you've had your time, because it would have been like, to use your analogy from earlier, it would have been like telling the town that Santa didn't exist. Yeah. It would have been to kind of kill our dreams. And even though we saw what was happening, he kind of had to play that out himself. This was a story that kind of, you know, the denouement of that story kind of had to happen of its own, or of Brian's will. And in the great scheme of things at that time, because it was still the first season of the Premier League and there was not huge money, going down was bad, but it wasn't the be-all end-all. We could see the bigger picture, and Clough leaving and Clough's decline was the bigger picture. So, for me, Clough was already addicted to alcohol a long time before and was subsiding, but in the 1990-91 season, I think it was sort of October 1990, Peter Taylor died, who was his former assistant and who he'd fallen out with, had never made back with. And Clough hinted later that he would have got back in touch with Peter Taylor and would have liked to have been friends with him again, because he was his confidant and his right-hand man. And he never did that before, and he suddenly died at the age of 62. And that kind of... That was almost the last of Clough, I think. Set him on this downward trend of, he kind of, maybe he saw what he'd been, maybe he saw the flaws in his personality and didn't like it, but I think that drove him further down. I don't think he would have been given time in the modern day, but quite frankly, I don't think he would have lasted 5 minutes in the modern day, because he would have said something in his unveiling and that would have been that, and he'd have been gone. It's hard to place him in the modern game and wonder anything, really.
I think I'll rephrase the Hillsborough question. Is that, was he the type of personality that ultimately had the information that is now available to everyone? He probably would have put his hand up and said, actually, I got that wrong at the time. Or do you think he was too stubborn?
Yeah, he was incredibly stubborn to the point that beyond reason and beyond decency, which is slightly clashes against who he was and what he represented as a person, because he was a huge socialist. He constantly stuck up for the local community, he stuck up for the fans, he stuck up for the miners in our area, and went on marches at that time. And he considered himself a man of the people above anything else. So it's difficult to know. I'd like to think he would have done. I mean, he certainly had no time for Margaret Thatcher and for establishment, both at that time in the late 80s and before and after. So I certainly would like to think he was on the side of the people. One thing I would say is I don't think he would have been able to do what Kenny Dalglish did if it had been the other way around and if they had been Forest fans. I don't think, the way Dalglish kind of took that responsibility on himself. And I know he retired in that 1991 season, a broken man, but he basically took the mantle of Liverpool Football Club, and Liverpool took it off the players, took it off the town, took it off the community, and basically bore it all on his own shoulders. I don't think Clough was strong enough to do that. I said this very recently on another podcast, but I'm not a big man for honours or that sort of thing, but I think Kenny Dalglish should be knighted for what he did after Hillsborough, because I don't think anyone could have been expected to take on what he did, and I certainly don't think Clough could have done it.
No, that's fair enough. Right, so we'll move on to the game. So it was against West Ham, and it was what was the name of the league then, when it was...
I think it was the English Championship. I think, yes, it would have been the English Championship. It was 2004-05. It was early-ish season. He passed away on the 20... Oh, that's bad. I think the 20th of September. 20th or 21st, but I think the 20th, which was, as I say, was my second day at university, and also the day after my birthday. So it kind of sticks on my mind then. And I probably was planning on going down to the West Ham game, because I knew a few people at uni who were Forest fans, But that event obviously made that a no-brainer. And Clough always used to wear a green jumper, and the club, who at that time were shambolic to say the least, actually dealt with the whole thing brilliantly. Forest were exceptional. They didn't put a foot wrong, and they very quickly organised this green jumper tribute so that everyone wore green, which is strange at the City Ground. And it was at a time when we were in wretched form, and afterwards we continued to be in wretched form and went down, but it became an occasion of that day, and it was a magnificent day.
And as the sort of question I posed, I think a little bit too early to you before, but is that the and I find myself getting a bit lump in the throat saying, is that the one, or have you ever since found the time of true belonging within football?
Probably not. Because of who I am, and certainly because of part of what Forest are, I normally tend to find my moments of closest belonging at times of suffering with Forest. So playoff semi-final defeats, we didn't get to final, playoff semi-final defeats, and close to be, you know, relegation fights, that sort of thing is generally where it stirs me more. But certainly in terms of a moment of community and belonging, there's nothing quite like that final goal going in. To briefly talk about the game, we fell 1-0 behind to West Ham with a goal from our former player Marlon Hayward, who didn't celebrate and was kind of widely applauded by the fans at the time for that. And we were awful, as we had been and would be all season, but we scored an equaliser with 6 minutes to go, and then scored a winner with, you know, in stoppage time, and it was a really good goal. It was scored by Marlon King, which is probably the one thing in the day I would change, because he was not popular, and then pointed at his own name and said, pointed to the fans, that he was proving himself because he'd been getting a bit of stick, which was the worst thing to do in the situation. But yes, that moment of, I don't believe in fatalism, but that moment, it did kind of feel like the script had been hijacked and that what was right to happen happened. It was a true sense of belonging. I saw people around me who, you know, I'd sat next to for years, who were crying with, not with happiness, really, and not with sadness, but just crying because that's how the emotion got out, which was lovely.
And that's what leads me. That's a good job. This interview is not face to face, Daniel, because I think we'd have to be blaming the cleaners for a lot of dust in the room. So when you arrived at the ground, what was the atmosphere like? What was it? Was it funereal? Was it celebratory? How was it?
It wasn't celebratory, but it was certainly gratitude. It was a day of thanks. Obviously, it was a day of mourning, but it was a day of thanks. And you know, the flowers and the shirts and the scarves that were put at the Forest gates were something that obviously I'd never seen before. Certainly in a sporting sense. Before the game, they had the replicas of all the trophies that Brian had won on the centre circle, and everyone in his team that was still around was on the pitch saying thanks. He famously liked Frank Sinatra, so we had Frank Sinatra clips, and we had My Way, which was his favourite song, before the game. So yes, it was a hugely, it actually felt quite, sometimes you see in South American football, you see these very over the top kind of funereal celebrations of people's lives, and it felt like that. It was very over the top, but also in a completely appropriate way, because he was, you know, he was Nottingham Forest.
Sorry, Dan, I just love the way you're saying that. You know, it was over the top. It was this, but you know, it was absolutely right. And the question I'd ask on that is that, did everyone join in with the singing of the song? Because I imagine I've always long campaigned for, just as an aside, for everyday songs, not football chants, but everyday songs to be sung by crowds. And was that a bizarre thing if that happened?
I think everyone did sing. I was just trying to think if we had sort of song sheets or anything. I can't remember. I think, but we definitely sang. If not every word, then certainly, you know, certainly the chorus and the build up. I mean, you've got to remember, at that time, everyone was still very raw, and there were a lot of people crying, and there were a lot of people, you know, very, very, very emotional. So it wasn't a kind of sing out proud the song, because that's not quite how it felt, and that's not really how My Way is as a song. But yes, people were singing along, and his team were on the, you know, his European Cup winning teams were on the pitch at that point. So they were obviously very emotional at the time. And the one thing of the day, I'd say, and that team were almost as a man useless that season. But the way that those players dealt with that pressure, they were awful during the game, but actually when it mattered in the last 10 minutes, the way that they played not necessarily a noise, but certainly with an atmosphere that I'd never experienced at the City Ground, not through just through noise, but a kind of a sort of murmur and a demand for them to step up. Because if we'd have lost that game 1-0, those players would have really struggled to get back any sort of kudos with the fans, or any sort of respect from the fans, if they'd have let them down. So fair play to the players for stepping up to that, because there were people in the crowd shaking that couldn't watch. So to be a player, to see European Cup winning players come on the pitch beforehand to be paraded, and then you were, I think we were third bottom or second bottom of the second tier at the time, to kind of bring yourself up is a huge achievement. So I'm eternally grateful to them for doing that.
Yeah, I mean, that makes absolute sense. But the actual game itself, how apart from the goals, was it much of a spectacle? Was it a game of 15 minutes? What was it? Can you actually remember that?
From what I can remember, it was wretched. But that's probably because that whole season, and to be honest, for a few seasons around that, were pretty bad. You know, at the end of that season, we were the first ever European Cup winners to be relegated to the third tier, which somehow felt quite fitting with Clough's passing, that the kind of the last elements of him had left the club. The game itself, I remember West Ham being on top. I remember Harewood's goal, because we loved Marlon Harewood. He was a trier, and he kind of sort of went off the radar after West Ham, which is a shame. But he was one of our own at the time. I remember applauding him for scoring and not celebrating and kind of doing some sort of, you know, with his arms, tribute to Cluffy. And then the game itself, I can't really remember, but I suspect was pretty bad until our equaliser was scored by Paul Evans, who is a small, I'll say tenacious, which is probably over complimenting him, but central midfielder. And as I say, the winner was scored by Marlon Harewood, who sort of picked the ball up maybe 30 or 40 yards out and ran towards goal and checked himself and then curled a shot into the top corner, which, because of where we were sat and because of the way the goal was, it was one of those goals that you could tell it was going in maybe 2 seconds before it actually did, which meant you got that extended rush of, oh my God, what we needed to happen is actually happening here. It's very rare in football that you can kind of experience a goal happening before it happens, but that was one of those. And so, which also meant it was one of those goals where everyone in the crowd is kind of celebrating it before it's even gone in, which for a goal like that was perfect.
Yeah. I'm just trying to work out. But as you say, the season ended with it, and there's... going down, was that possibly a symbol, and without getting too deep, but was that a symbol of the end times of Clough as well, as that was, you know, or was it just something that was inevitably going to happen anyway?
I will say that Joe Kinnear was our manager on that day, so that, I mean, the last remnants of great managers had been lost by that point, there is no doubt, and we had some rotten managers and some rotten players. The club was being not mismanaged, because the owner cared, but just that we were losing a lot of money at that time. We went down in pretty abject fashion, but we weren't ever expected to compete in that league. My worst ever game that I went to was a 2-2 home draw with Rotherham that season, who also went down with us with a record low points total. It was a horrible, horrible season. It didn't feel in any way poetic or philosophical that we were going down, put it that way, because we didn't want to go to League One, and League One was a slog that we took a long time to get, far too long to get out of. Again, with awful playoff defeats. So it did. No, at the time it didn't. I can't pretend that it felt like any sort of poetic, well, this is just fitting. We were too angry and upset for that. But but looking back on it, it was kind of the medicine that the club needed to take, because we were at best treading water. We arguably still are, even so many years afterwards. And there is an argument to say that the club has still never really got over Cluffy's omnipotence, because we were a club that, apart from in the mid-90s, we're a club that's pretty much floundered ever since. And we're a big club that's floundered ever since. So, but we wouldn't change it for the world. Yeah, it's Ronaldo, and my favourite player, or maybe my favourite non-Nottingham Forest player as a child, because of his ability, not because of his rehabilitation, actually, just because he was incredible to watch and had everything and did it with a smile, which is, as a kid, that's basically all you want. He felt mysterious, but you still tried to copy him. But the rehabilitation is effectively superhuman. Ronaldo was supposed to be coronated in the 1998 World Cup final. He was the poster boy of that World Cup. He was certainly Nike's poster boy. And we will never truly know what happened on the night of that 1998 World Cup final. In an era before social media, it's kind of become hazy. But if that happened now, it would be the story of the decade. But what we do know is that he basically suffered either a panic attack or certainly some sort of convulsions in the night before the game, and they continued into the day. And what it certainly seems like is that he suffered from the pressure that was basically placed upon him, and played in that final, but to all intents and purposes didn't play in that final. To then suffer the injuries. Sorry, go on.
No, I was going to say that's the case. I watched that family final as an 18-year-old, and I remember thinking, this Brazil may as well have gone out with 10 men.
Absolutely, and even less, because they almost had to continue this charade of constantly getting the ball to him, which was a perfectly reasonable tactic when he was on form and he was brilliant throughout that tournament, but wasn't a reasonable tactic when he was in the condition he was in that night. And it was such a dance group and such a letdown. And kind of, even if he had then been top scorer in the 2002 World Cup and scored both goals in the 2002 World Cup final, just after that, it would be an incredible story. But to have this basically 4 years of injuries, he sustained a ruptured tendon, I think it was. Yeah, ruptured tendon in 99. So between November 99 and May 2002, he played 23 club games. And that May 2002 was obviously a month before the 2002 World Cup began. So he was broken. His legs were broken. And this was a story of the great hope defeated by his own body and by injury. So to get himself fit again, not just fit again for the World Cup, but to get himself firing again is, well, I'm biased, but because I picked it, but I think the greatest sporting story of the last two decades.
Well, the question I was going to ask you was, do you think it's the greatest World Cup performance? But you've kind of nipped that one in the bud and gone above it. Why can you go into more detail? Why do you think...
Ronaldo was always going to have the potential to be the greatest player, the greatest striker in the world. That was clear from the age of 8, 9, 10, all the way up to 16 when he was sold to Cruzeiro and then went to PSV Eindhoven. He scored 5 goals in a game at the age of 17 for Cruzeiro, and at 20 he was the best player in the world. That's basically a career. That's a normal person's career to move up that quickly and become the best player in the world. I say a normal person's career. It's a non-normal career, but he made himself the best player in the world at 20. He won the World Player of the Year at 20, the youngest ever winner. And then the heartache came. So having already had one career, he basically had another career, which was a career of a player who is decimated by injuries, and a sad story, a tragic tale. And then by 2002, he made himself the best striker in the world again, despite barely training, despite having his knees effectively and his tendons effectively remade by doctors, having to learn to not just to you know, to score goals again, but basically having to learn how to run and how to, you know, the skills, try it all again. So again, as I say, I'm biased because I love football and I love Ronaldo and I love rehabilitation stories because of a big soft heart. But yeah, for me, it's the greatest story. And his position as the greatest striker is not really open to debate in terms of this generation. You know, Van Basten calls him it, Ibrahimovic calls him it, Thierry Henry calls him it, Lionel Messi says he's the best striker he's ever seen. So these are the best of the best rating him as better, basically.
When he came back in 2002, he was, I mean, this what makes it part of it for me is that apart from that, I mean, you know, we, being the British or the English people we are, we can't let them have everything. You know, he came back with that awful haircut, didn't he?
He did.
And that stood out in the first place. But I always remember he came back and he was massive, but he wasn't fat. He was a unit, and I couldn't believe the speed at which he still moved. And was that the big thing? Is that he came back and nothing seemed to have changed, even though he'd had 4 years of injuries.
Yeah, there's a quote he says. I think it was before. Yeah, it was before the World Cup final itself, not the finals. But he says basically, my only victory was to play football again and to run again. It was never to, you know, it was never to do this. So it was a triumph of. And Ronaldo was a worker, but he wasn't because he was, you know, being very stereotypical, but because of his personality and perhaps because of his nationality, he wasn't, you know, this was not a just achieved constantly through hard work. This was basically a triumph of natural ability over natural flaws, kind of the good versus evil of his own body. So for that to happen, and as you say, to come back and hit the ground literally running and literally scoring, it was obscene. It was absolutely obscene. And because it was 15 years ago now, we kind of overlook it, but it's basically like Ronaldo or Messi suffering 3 years of constant injuries. And they're, you know, even if a player now gets one serious injury, we rule them out. You know, they dip out of our thoughts. But 3 years of injuries and then coming back and doing exactly the same before he left, it just hasn't happened before, and I don't think it will happen again.
Where was he at the time? Was he at Inter then?
He was at Inter then, which is when he basically suffered almost all of his injuries, and at least partly they have been put down to how much football he played when he was younger. As I say, he was the best player in the world at 20, which has its own pressures and brings its own responsibilities to be picked every week. We've seen that and I'm not making the comparison, but we've seen that with players like Harry came, where if they are even, you know, 80% fit, they start because that's the difference they make, so they're needed. And then he obviously went on to Real Madrid, and for a player who was, you know, had problems with his weight because of illness and had problems certainly with injury, and therefore it slowed him down earlier than it would otherwise have done. He played on for a heck of a long time at Real Madrid. I mean, the reason I love Ronaldo is he basically broke the mold. You know, players are supposed to be getting better in every area now, as medical science and technology and nutrition and training improves. But it's difficult to see how there can be a better version of a centre forward than Ronaldo. His speed, his stamina, his finishing, his skill, everything was computer game player like. It was like cheat mode. Normally they're not the players I have an affinity with, the best players in the world. But because there was such this obvious personal backstory to him, and because he was a very likable bloke, everyone bought into it.
I'm trying to remember now, I'm going through quickly, so forgive me if I'm right or wrong. But when you started writing Portrait of an Icon, was that driven by Ronaldo? Was that, have you done Ronaldo? Is that where you got the idea from?
Yeah, I did. I have done him. He wasn't actually. I mean, Portrait of an Icon kind of started as a Sarah Winterburn saying to me, right, you need a Monday piece or a Monday afternoon piece, and me saying, well, I like waffling and navel gazing and old players, so can I do that? And her saying yes. And it started with Bergkamp in October 2015, and not even intended as a weekly piece or a regular piece, just to do it. And it kind of snowballed from there. It only really became a thing after I did, I think I did Bobby Robson in the third week, and then it kind of clicked that this could become a thing. But having clicked, Ronaldo was always going to be, you know, not just one that I was going to do, but one that I was going to really enjoy. And to kind of let you behind the curtain, there were some that, you know, I wrote these on a Monday afternoon, but there were some that I kind of decided, right, I'll start at one on a Monday and write all night and make sure I try and get it right, because some of them, 3 hours was enough to kind of do the research and get it done, but others I kind of wanted to experience it without that sounding too wanky. Because these are my favourite players of my favourite thing in the world, so why wouldn't I want to make the most of the chance to write about them? Because it's a series that you can only do once. I can never really write about Ronaldo again. I can never really write about any of them again. So, yes, it was a very, very enjoyable day.
Yeah, I'm the same with Dennis Stracolesi. But the aspect is, the other thing, just before we actually talk about his individual performances, do you think he was helped by the fact that in 98 he was the star and that's that? But in 2002, Brazil had other players that could take the pressure off him. I'm thinking specifically Ronaldinho. You know, do you think that he was able just to do what he did because he didn't have to do it for everyone?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And also because there were such low expectations of him after injury. If he was fit, he was always going to be in the squad. There's no doubt about that. But he was, I strongly suspect that going into that tournament, he was kind of the wild card striker. It was, if we get something out of him, then brilliant. But yes, they had Rivaldo and they had Ronaldinho. So yeah, Adriano, I guess, is in that squad. So they clearly had options. But then, as we said, the natural talent kind of took over. And as soon as he started scoring, there was absolutely no doubt that he was going to stay in that team. And if you pick Ronaldo, he scores goals.
The running theme, it's just occurred to me, for both your memory and your moments, is the script. So once Brazil got to that final, that the script was always going to be Ronaldo, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, that quite rightly makes me sound like I should just watch soap operas rather than football. But I'm an absolute, I'm a git for a strip like that. And football doesn't produce that many of them, and it certainly doesn't produce that many of them where there's very little, there's not really a negative side that you have to kind of ignore to enjoy the positives. You know, the Ronaldo story is virtually flaw free in terms of script. It is the perfect script, and it happened. I am a git for that. I'm a dreadful, dreadful, soppy romantic, I'm afraid.
There's absolutely nothing wrong with that. But do you think then? I mean, is the standout moment for you? I mean, I know that the moment is the journey from 98 to 2002. But is the final the standout moment for you?
Yes, it's certainly a moment I remember the most. I remember him scoring against, I think their first game was Turkey, and he scored. They went behind in the first half, and he scored the equaliser. And then Rivaldo scored the winner. So I remember that because it was his first goal back. And obviously at the time we weren't able to watch a huge amount of foreign football. So we knew what Ronaldo was doing, but I hadn't been able to completely track. You know, how old would I have been? 16. 15. So I wouldn't have been completely tracking his injury progress. It was just, oh, that's a shame he's out. So I remember the joy, because with always with Ronaldo, what you remember was the smile after you remember the goal, and then you remember the smile. Yeah. And I remember the smile after the Turkey game, which was the first one. And then, yes, all about the final. And not just the final, but him being held aloft by his teammates at the end of that final and kind of carried around the pitch and receiving the coronation that he deserved in 1998. France and Zidane played very well, but the one that seemed fitting in 1998.
The goals he scored, if I remember rightly, they were classic Ronaldo's goals as well, weren't they? The particularly running on, and the, again, it was this pace he had, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. He is a very much a cliche striker, because all those cliches you think about, kind of running faster with the ball than without it, and you know, first yard in his head, and all those, they're all valid for Ronaldo. And yeah, I mentioned the idea of cheat mode before, and that's how most of his goals looked. It just looked like he was on a different level. You just thought, well, there's not even much point trying to run after him, because you're not going to catch him, and there's not much point trying to save it, because he's going to put it in the corner. And you know, he had his party trick, which was rounding goalkeepers, but that's only because he got so many one-on-ones, because he was so far ahead of generally so far ahead of the defence. You know, if he ran onto a through ball, he was suddenly 10 yards ahead of a defender. Therefore, he had at least a couple of seconds to pick his next move. And sometimes he slotted it past, but quite often he rounded the keeper just for the joy of it, really. There's a really lovely story by, it was Bobby Robson's kind of said, he was asked whether he kind of had his heart in his mouth every time Ronaldo went through on goal and rounded the keeper rather than choosing to score, because it's not the percentage move that, and he just kind of said, well, you know, if he keeps scoring, I don't mind. And to be honest, Robson and Ronaldo's relationship is one of the reasons that I have such an affinity with him anyway. There's a wonderful quote by Robson where he says, "If imagine you had asked God to be the best, be the best footballer in the world, and he actually listened to you," which again is a much more eloquent way of that idea of cheat mode that I've just said, because Bobby is more eloquent than I could ever hope to be.
And that is, isn't it, he was, he delivered, and he, as you say, he broke the mould, but also he's the template for every single player that's out there now, really, isn't he? Every single striker, you know, strikers can do this now. Well, he did that first. Well, strikers can do this now. He did that first, and he scored. He was a scorer of great goals, but he was a great goal scorer. He was one of the few that actually does both.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you're absolutely right. You can compare your players now can compare themselves to one aspect of his game, but they can, you know, the only other person in, you know, not in my memory because I don't remember, the only other person in my lifetime that comes anywhere close to Ronaldo, in my opinion, is Marco van Basten. And yet he would have to accept that on at least two or three characteristics, he was miles behind Ronaldo.
Yeah.
It's frightening. We won't see the like of it again. I don't like comparing players from different generations, because I think it's pretty trite and it's not particularly helpful. It leads to people supporting players rather than clubs, but he's an absolute phenom.
The thoughts I'm getting, though, just one thing to follow, and it is a bit of a what if, because my own Ronaldo moment that I think capped off the rehabilitation. I actually think the World Cup is the second to last, or the penultimate step towards the final thing was United, when he scored the hat trick for Madrid at United. And he was clapped off by the United fans when he went off. But the question I want to ask to get to that point, Daniel, is do you think if he turned up to the World Cup, scored a goal and maybe played 3.5 games and Brazil still won it, do you think he would have been able to progress his career afterwards still?
It's a good question. He was certainly a confidence player, although somehow managed to not get completely downbeaten or downtrodden by his injuries. I suspect Ronaldo would always have played football because he did it for the joy. Whether he would have been able to take it on to the highest level, I certainly think, to kind of half answer your question, I certainly think that World Cup proved to European super clubs that he was worth taking a chance on, because they were always going to have to pay a high price. But it was worth them doing that because they saw that even after, you know, an injury run that almost no other player had ever experienced, he was still there so soon afterwards. So I think it certainly enabled his latter club career, because they then thought, well, obviously we're going to take a chance on him. And obviously we're talking about Real Madrid there. So yes, possibly. The clubs like Real were brilliant for Ronaldo. One thing he was very much a benefactor of, a beneficiary of, is incredible service. You know, it didn't have to be a brilliant pass for Ronaldo to make it into a brilliant goal, but he didn't. He got brilliant passes at pretty much every club and certainly with his country. And Real, although my favourite Ronaldo is the season at Barcelona under Bobby in 96-97 when he was, you know, when he was 20 and scored 34 league goals at 20. The Real was certainly the mature, developed Ronaldo and the complete player that as you say scored that hat trick and got applauded not just because he was brilliant but because of the backstory.
I completely agree. It was the acknowledgement that this is a player that has been through hell and back and is still as good as he was before he started that journey. And I know you're not a fan of comparing, but when it comes to rest,
yeah.
Where would you place Ronaldo as in terms of the footballing sense, not just the striking sense? Is he in the pantheon of the greats?
Yeah, he is one of the. He's certainly one of the pillars of my footballing life. So 1990 onwards, he's certainly one of those pillars. He would walk into my team up front. He's certainly one of the pillars. It's hard to judge because I can't judge him without the backstory and yet without the backstory maybe he would be even better, but that kind of forms his reputation in my eyes anyway. So I wouldn't have him any. I'm sure he would have preferred not to get those injuries, but I wouldn't have him any other way.